nation of crime. An empire of sickos.
These are the same people who show up, the Occupy Wall Street.
An FBI without a leader.
Effective immediately, James Comey is fired as director of the FBI.
The president has terminated the director.
A fallen hero will rise.
Yo, yo, you fogel! You a legend behind these walls, man!
I was.
Yo, you got people out there, man. People that want to get you out.
My story is over. I'm just another sandwich pitch man who turned out to be a sex criminal. Same old story.
And a president who thought outside the box.
Okay, look. Jared Fogel is the new FBI director. Look, he did something awful. He did something very, very bad. He was very, very fat. It's awful, very bad. He knows how these sickos think, and now he can help us catch them.
You know who I am. You know what I've done. Now you'll see what I can do. Taking down predators 1 foot at a time.
Director Fogel, I've got my eye on you. When you slip up, I'm gonna be there and make sure the whole world sees it.
If you're waiting for me to screw up, Agent Haynes, I suggest you eat fresh, because it's not gonna be happening for a pretty foot-long time.
Sometimes it takes a sandwich sicko to catch a pizza predator. From executive producer Kurt Sutter to creator of The Bastard Executioner and Cholo's Angels presents The Fresh Connection, coming this summer to FXX.
Hello, friends. It's your Chapo for this week. We got a full house. Let's sound off. Chapo roll call. Me, Will Meneker.
Hey, everyone. It's Virgil Texas.
It's Felix Biederman. I'm out here pussy popping for James Comey.
It's Brennan James.
Matt Crispin. Ah, fuck.
In a little bit, we'll be talking to Matt Brunig about his new efforts to get a left-wing think tank and policy shop off the ground. And in just a second, we're going to hear from our own Virgil Texas, who's going to give us an update on some special election news.
Also, a little Easter egg for fans with the Matt Brunig interview, just as we were recording it. Stay tuned for some interesting textural audio where Virgil, I made him some tea, and he continues to just smack his lips, enjoying the tea for the entire interview. And Felix, who you only just started doing this, but you just continue to rub the microphone against your beard in a soothing way very much picks up on the microphone.
Professionalism.
Okay, look,
the watchword here.
I want to explain to the listeners. I accidentally shaved my entire beard about 3 weeks ago. Now it's back. It's about as big as ever, and I like to feel it in the holes of the microphone. I like to pretend that I'm a bug who can only breathe that way. And it's normal. This is regular guy shit, yeah. And you just think it's weird because you're not a regular guy.
I'm not editing it out, so enjoy
Felix
that.
I'm really enjoying it, though, because it's the hottest ASMR I've ever heard, and I'm about to nut.
Yeah, but before we get to those topics, and then a little bit later, of course, after the interview, we are going to revisit an old friend of the show, Kevin Dracula Williamson.
You could maybe call him a friend who cannot die.
Yeah, the best friendships live forever.
Most NRO people die because their hearts stop because they ate too much steak. Kevin can only die because you put a steak in his heart.
But before we get to any of those fun topics, I suppose we should address right at the top of the show, as we did in our hilarious little cold open there. I suppose the timely and big news of this past week was the firing of FBI Director Little Comey Gay Ass by President Donald Trump. As far as this goes, I feel like this, along with every one of these sort of resistance scandals and Russia collusion thing, I feel like I I'm pretty numb to, and I'm just sort of watching as a detached outside observer. I find it amusing. I'm in favor of, honestly, anything that stitches up Trump or the Republicans, but I don't know. I can't muster anything too substantial to say about it. I don't know. How do you guys feel?
James, you don't feel anything for James Comey, the man who personally entrapped autistic Muslim teenagers and fooled them into saying on tape that they were going to kill Inspector Gadget and put them in prison forever. The man who defended your freedom that way. I welcome him to the resistance.
Probably the greatest patriot of all time of any country. And the new leader of the resistance. And I'm going to say it, Comey 2020.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's bizarre. It's hilarious. It is, again, blatantly obvious what's going on. Trump basically fired him because he wasn't going to be a...
Well, he fucking said that. That's
yeah.
What's so
yeah.
amazing about Trump is that at every step, like, these people keep going, what's his game plan? What's Trump thinking? What kind of strategy is he using? And then he will just destroy it instantly by just talking until he says something that incriminates himself because he's got the brain of an Alzheimer's patient. He doesn't know what he's saying or care at any given moment. And because the Republicans control both houses of Congress, nothing he says matters. That's what's so mm-hmm. amazing is that this guy he's like a billionth as smart as Nixon. But he will never go down the way Nixon did because Nixon had a piranha-like Democrats in charge of the House and Senate who wanted to bring him down. So because he's got these Republicans in Congress, they're just going to keep letting him do whatever he wants. He's basically like when Homer was the chosen one and everybody, you know, like they shot the last bowling pin so that he'd have a strike or they tipped over the pool table so that all the balls went into one hole. And that's what he's going to be doing for the next 4 to 8 years. It's going to be amazing. Trump says, hey, you better watch Comey. You might have been taped. And people are like, wait a minute. You've got a tape? And he's like, maybe. And then, That's it. We're done. Nothing else is going to happen from that. Well, because there's nobody in a position of authority to make it happen. Nobody with subpoena power. Nobody with the investigative ability to do anything.
Well, the one thing that I absolutely... I mentioned this on Twitter, but like it still like just warms my heart to think about. I think it was in the Lester Holt interview. Trump said he fired Comey because he was a showboat, and I just love like it's just like I just I, if I, like I said, if he announces a replacement and describes him as a gritty lunch pail prosecutor, like I'm gonna die.
It's actually Joe Flacco. He's the new FBI director.
That interview was amazing. So they go through the trouble because obviously, as he said in public, he didn't like that he wasn't ending the Russia investigation, and he wanted to fire him for that reason. But all of the non-morons around him realized that that would look bad, so the AG and the deputy AG wrote this advisory letter, right, that said, you know, he fucked up the Hillary thing, and you can't really keep him on. And then when they initially fired him, what did he say? He said, I was advised by my attorney general and deputy attorney general to do this. And then 2 days later, he's interviewed and he's like, look, I was going to do it anyway. It's not like Lester Holt tricked him into saying that. It's not like he was foiled by some genius of investigative journalism. He just kept talking.
That's what's so amazing about all the tweetstorm people that are like, if you take the first word from every letter of Trump's tweets in April of 2013, it spells out Putin plan. It's like you're watching a child running around the playground with shit in his pants and sliding down that sort of fireman's pole and smearing shit everywhere and going, what's your plan, you Machiavellian bastard? Like, he'll just tell you because he loves talking.
Can't handle the reality that we have such broken institutions that a idiot king, boy king who is dumber than every one of the most deformed Habsburgs can yes. rule without challenge. Because he serves the interests of a political party that has control of every institution that's supposed to check his power.
Yet not the support of a majority of Americans.
Doesn't matter. None of it matters. It's all it's collapsed. It's just this it's just this machine that carries forth basically of its own momentum with no actual civic will behind it.
Well, Matt,
the spirit has totally deserted it.
I've loved your metaphor before, that it's just like the Terminator, like the T-800 synthetic flesh has just melted off, and now it's just the red eyes of this gleaming metallic skull.
Yeah, like you people thought these institutions worked because they had inherent legitimacy, because they were good institutions, tried and true. No, they work because they serve people in power. And if the dumbest man in the history of the world can just get into the cockpit and start moving the gears around and the plane keeps going in the same direction, maybe they're not actually hooked up to anything.
What to me was a sea change was, after the Comey firing, Democratic congressman, not Maxine Waters, were openly stating impeachment. And it took so long in the Bush era for that to become the case.
Yeah, and they'll keep saying that, and no one will be listening to them because
they
don't
have
the ability to put forth any kind of impeachment.
This is why I feel,
or investigation at all. They have no ability to independently investigate any of this.
But this is why I'm left numb by all of this, because, like, let's say they do impeach Trump and get him out there, get him out of the, you know, just you're fired, President Trump, you're gone, he's impeached. Then we're every bit as fucked, if not worse, because Mike Pence is in charge. And I guarantee you all the people who are so shocked and totally appalled by Trump would find some way of, like, congratulating Mike Pence.
Oh, yeah. I can see it now. Like, Pence goes on some diplomatic visit where he holds hands with the king of Saudi Arabia, or fucking just, you know, kisses Netanyahu on the mouth. And people are like, well, I may not agree with him, but at least he's bringing honor back to the White House.
Well, and the other thing is, like, again, I'm sure all this Russia shit is dirty, and were it a Democratic president, they would have already been impeached. There would have already been, like, a massive hearing and, you know, independent investigation into this, and, like, every fucking statement and thing would be drilled down on. But for the reasons Matt has quite ably laid out, that's not going to happen with Trump, at least not now. Mm-hmm. Something could happen in the future. Like, who the fuck knows? But I think, like, what annoys me about this is just that, like, you know, all this constitutional crisis stuff. It's just like, the crisis is the Republican Party. The crisis is right-wing governance of America. Like, that's the fucking problem. And it doesn't start with Trump. And if you whacked him out, like, you know, if you got him out of there tomorrow, we'd be just as fucked.
It's interesting because it's like, I think it was our old pal Crank who said a few weeks ago.
The baseball Crank?
Yeah, the baseball Crank.
The b-ball Crank.
Yeah. The billiards fool.
The baseball Crank, who said a few weeks ago, a lot of the outrage against Trump is actually outrage at Republican policies getting enacted. And it's like, yes, that's exactly the problem.
They're terrible. And I mean, this is kind of why we get so infuriated by things that don't seem like that big of a deal. Things like, you know, rehabilitating David Frum by putting him in The Atlantic and having him write a cover story about authoritarianism, or putting fucking Bret Stephens in The New York Times, as we talked about a couple episodes ago. It's not that we're like, this guy just sucks, but that's part of it. It's that they got us here, and we're congratulating them for not being Trump, even though they would do the exact same policies, just with less senile mud holes in their brain.
In any other country, the U.S. Republican Party would be the fascist rump party. It would be called the Blood and Soil Party. Mm. Have any of you seen the film Goodbye, Lenin?
Yeah,
this could be a way out, because Trump only operates, like, talks to three people every day.
Explain the concept of that movie, though.
It's set in Germany after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and this old woman was, like, from East Germany. She was a true believer in that. She falls into a coma right before the wall falls, and then she wakes up, like, 10 years later after unification, and her doting son is told that she has to, if she hears anything very shocking, she's very fragile, she might die. So he makes this elaborate ruse to convince her that East Germany is still communist.
Right.
It's a very madcap fun film. Now, what if you could do this with Trump and just hack into, make false, like, Fox and Friends and all the fucking bullshit TV shows, make just totally fake, use CGI to do it, and just have them all report, well, looks like that's it. Donald Trump has been impeached and removed from office. And he wouldn't even react. He would just look at it and just say, this is ludicrous. This is bullshit. As he's walking out. Just walk out onto the street. And that would be the end of it.
Well, it's like Small Brain was, I don't give a fuck that Comey, who cares about Comey? his personal firing.
First of all, what the fuck? Second of all, are you okay?
And then, so it's there's absolutely nothing to register on that. Then people go, well, it's not that. It's, you know, the Russia stuff. And it's like, okay, fine. But again, as Matt has spelled out and we've talked about before, there's definitely some dirty Russia shit. But for the time being, nothing's going to happen there. It's a unitary government. They have control of everything. Forget it. It's not going to happen. And then beyond that, universe brain is like, even if we found out that he was doing, because the allegation with the Russia stuff is that he like coordinated media shit with RT or Sputnik. Like it's not that he hacked, the Putin and Russian hackers hacked voting booths. That's already been 100% debunked. Mm-hmm. That's just not what the allegation is whatsoever. Yeah. That would be pretty freaky if that were the case. So they actually hacked the election. But that's not it. It's this media campaign stuff that's probably illegal. But like, even if we found that out, I don't give a fuck.
The thing about, I mean, people talk about trying to find these transactions with Russia. Look, they probably exist. He's an easy guy to pay off and bribe. He's stupid. He doesn't pay attention. Yeah. But there's way more documented proof of the Saudis buying him off. But that's, you know, just a country that we allow to buy people off.
He's going
off
to visit them on his first overseas trip.
They, you know, they moved their embassy. Previously, they had bought the entire 45th floor of Trump Tower. But they, immediately after he won, they moved some property they had in New York. They sold it and bought stuff closer to Trump Tower. The thing about the Russia thing for me, and the caveat I feel with people going, well, it's a way to get him out of here. I'm afraid of that being the thing that gets him out of here, because our next president, be them like, you know, fucking Kirsten Gillibrand on one end, or like, you know, maybe fucking John Kasich on the other end, they'll have this. They'll be told, and they will think that they have to do this. They have to confront Russia, and that means we up our involvement in proxy conflicts in Ukraine and all over Baltic states, that we now fully initiate regime change in Syria. There is just an endless, horrifying world of possibilities that standing up to Russia means. It's one of those things that people say that they think means something, and they just think it means like going up to Putin and having a major mic drop moment. But what it means in reality is you give some more money to some Nazis in Ukraine, you end up filling a ditch full of Shia in Syria. It's never anything good. These proxy conflicts never lead to anything fucking good.
Well, I think just, you know, last thought on this is just spare a thought for Director Comey, who I'm sure now will go to the private sector, where he will make a living continuing to entrap Muslim teenagers by getting them to say that they want to blow up diesel trains on tape and aiding and abetting the crimes of their paid criminal informants. He's going to be doing that in the private sector now, probably at some, you know, like I said, private firm that is also greatly expanding our surveillance and police state.
So, probably does business with Russia.
Probably. So, yeah, that's enough. That's enough Comey talk.
Bye, Mr. Cummies.
let's move on now. Virgil, you've prepared a little segment that's going to inform us and the listener about some of these special elections.
And oh boy, are they special!
This is some real Carl Digler shit right now.
If you want Trump to actually be impeached by the House of Representatives, then you know there has to be a Democratic majority come 2018, and there are two races coming up, three actually, but two are more. Two competitive races coming up, and I want to talk about two of them, both of them. All right, first off, you all know this one, Georgia's 6th District, which is the most expensive House race in U.S. history right now. This is the runoff between Democrat John Ossoff and Republican Karen Handel, and in the first round of this, Democrats combined for 48.5% of the vote, Republicans for 51.5% of the vote. This is a district, Charlie Cook rates it an R+9 district, which means that if you average the past two presidential results in that district, you get Republicans winning by 9%. Tom Price won in 2016 by something like 24% of the vote, while Trump won by just 1% of the vote. And that's why this is a competitive district. And the polls show this is about a 50-50 proposition. There's going to be the money there. There's going to be the money to drive turnout. And it's really going to be a barometer of how people in this particular district with its demographics feel about the president right now. And regarding the demographics, this is a district that was, it's a suburban Atlanta. It's affluent. It was 90% white when Newt Gingrich represented it. Now it's 70% white. It's 20% foreign-born, with majority minority area subdivisions that are virtually all Asian-American professionals.
I just like that, and actually, it went from being 90 to 70% white just when Newt Gingrich left the district.
So what happens when you have an affluent, white, suburban area with an influx of non-whites? It's time to make the racism. So, the GOP message against John Ossoff has been, he is not one of us. They use that line over and over again in their ads while tying him to the Democrats' super effectual and totally hated House leader, Nancy Pelosi, who was kept on as minority leader for what I am certain are reasons.
Her San Francisco values. Didn't they have a TV commercial?
Yes, a recent attack ad showed actors playing San Franciscans praising Ossoff as their representative, one of whom, of course, was a woman standing in China. Town. And befitting the state where a triple amputee Vietnam veteran was smeared as pro-Al-Qaeda, Paul Ryan's super PAC ran ads saying Ossoff is on Al Jazeera's payroll, complete with images of Osama bin Laden and ISIS flags. And the Georgia GOP ran mailers with the Al Jazeera logo saying, once you've worked for them, you can't work for us.
Did he work for Al Jazeera?
He had a Ossoff was, he was a documentarian, and he had a production company in the UK that did some footage for Al Jazeera. It was mostly about things like sex slavery in Iraq. So once
was
again,
he pro or anti?
I don't know. PolitiFact has not rated that. No. But once again, there's no such thing as a good Republican. All trash. A little about the candidates. Karen Handel ran policy at the corporate pinkwashing outfit Susan Komen, where she got them to cut ties with Planned Parenthood.
Oh, that was her?
Yeah, that was her.
That was like a huge fuck up.
Yeah, she fucked up.
That was like
an
all-time fuck up for like what was once a major charitable organization.
Yeah. And John Ossoff is 30, a documentarian, like I said, and he's a real go-getter.
He's 30?
Yeah, he's 30.
Wow. Whoa. Yep. Young gunner.
Yeah. He's a go-getter. He went to all the right schools. He studied at Georgetown, took classes with Madeleine Albright, and interned for...
So he probably sucks, too, is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. He's running on budget deficit shit, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, we're going to cut waste in office.
And it's less important for the House, but he's super anti-BDS. He's super... You know, what you'd expect for a guy who came up with Albright.
He is, he's not a socialist, as famously Bernie Sanders said. He is probably would sit in the right wing of a Democratic center-left caucus. And he's running just a very basic make Trump mad type race, not trying to rock the vote. Because to win in this district, he's going to need a not just expanded turnout from younger, more left-oriented voters who don't turn out for midterms and don't turn out for specials, but he also needs to peel off some of these habitual Republican suburban white voters who are appalled by Trump. And going to that, polling shows the race is essentially tied. It's a coin flip. It's a game of inches, not yards, to use a sports ball analogy. And in terms of midterms and specials, the electorate is older, whiter, more reactionary. But in the first round, you know, Ossoff and the Dems did do a good job of turning out young anti-Trump people and peeling off some Republican voters who hate the president. According to Nate Cohn, Ossoff won 15% to 20% of past GOP primary voters. This was a blanket primary. Anyone could vote for any candidate. So, honestly, it could go either way. I don't think...
No, it won't. The Republican will win.
And another similar district is Montana, which is an at-large district.
Rob Quist.
Where Rob Quist, who is probably more...
Pretty good.
A Bernard brother, would you say?
He is a Bernard brother, and he is also, pursuant to something Matt told me once, he's a celebrity and a charismatic guy. Rob Quist was a local folk musician who he's well known within the state, and if you're like a huge on folk music, and also I think he's big in Japan for some reason. So he's like a cowboy, dreamy cowboy poet who supports single payer healthcare and has made that the centerpiece of his campaign. He's running against Gianfort, a literal tech multimillionaire who just lost the gubernatorial race in 2016, even while Trump was carrying the state by over 10 points. He lost by just a couple points, and he's back. He's pouring some poured a few million dollars of his personal fortune into the race, but Quist has sucked up also a lot of donations too. So I think they might be going dollar for dollar there.
It's the Linda McMahon model of
basically. But he got slammed in the gubernatorial race for some fucking property related thing. He's like wanted to tear down a tree or something. I don't know. That's the kind of crap that pisses off people in Montana. Also, he's kind of a carpetbagger, so he gets attacked for that. Quist, he got hit with some very bad press about loans he defaulted on, not paying people. That shit looks very bad too. But he's also met, you know, a lot of enthusiasm in Montana, like he's filling auditoriums and stuff like that. So it's tough to see. He is down though. And again, this is not like Georgia's 6th District, which went for Trump by just 1 point and not a majority. This is Montana, which went for Trump pretty big. But again, people were not excited for Hillary Clinton. People are now very mad at Trump and excited for a guy like this. So in the polls, he's down by 8 to 10 points. There's a Libertarian and a Green Party candidate on the ballot. But tellingly, the Republican candidate has not been able to clear 50% on the vote, on the polls. And he was at 48% in 2016. And he could land there now. It's really a question if Quist can galvanize as many voters as possible to who don't normally come out to come out.
I'm going to say he will not, and he will lose too.
That was the very special election report by our very special election reporter from Texas. Okay, let's hear from Matt Brunig now. I think for the purposes of this interview, Matt Christman, if you wouldn't mind, could I refer to you as Kush or just Christman or Matt Christman? I don't know. This could get confusing.
Can we do Matt Prime?
How about Christman knocked?
Kush is good.
I try to suggest something and no one wants to do it.
Oh, and Maddie B. Actually, I'll just call Matt Brunig Maddie B. Raps.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Maddie B. Stats.
Maddie B. Stats. Here we go.
That's good.
Please tell me you're recording all this gold, Brendan.
Yeah, it's all okay. Look at the little lights that light up.
We got callers on the line.
Hello.
Yeah. Hey, mad dog.
We're talking here now with Matt Brunig. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I feel that this is a long time coming, this one. First time, long time guest. But we're having you on today because you just entered the Patreon racket. Matt Brunig is creating harassment, targeted pylons, and silencing. So we saw that and we were like, okay, we got to get Matt on to talk about this. This is a cause we support. We want to just get the message out there. Just pick a target, harass them, pile on, tell your followers to do the same.
Guys, if you like Matt, you need to get out there, spam his Patreon and people while saying class is greater than race. That's all you got to say.
That's right. That's going to be the name of the think tank. Class and then a greater sign and then race.
I want to talk about the specifics, but the first thing I noticed when I go to your Patreon page, which is it's not actually about harassment. You are setting up what is essentially a left-wing policy shop. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Well, the first thing I notice when I go to your amazing banner image is the classic Fox News graphic, Entitlement Nation. And it's a giant hand busting through a map of the United States saying, gimme. So what are you looking to be given by your betters, by people who work for a living?
Yeah, well, I'm just looking for money so that I can pay people to write policy papers and pay for videos and pay for a website and that sort of thing. Pay myself some, depending on how that all plays out. And, you know, I have pretty good connections in the media and I have pretty good connections, around DC and the think tank sphere through back channels, not, you know, publicly. So I think I can make this work in a way that other people may not be able to. So, affect the discourse, get some policy papers out there that could actually be used. For instance, there's not a single payer paper out there, which is bizarre since that seems to be the majority preference of people in the U.S. So could put something like that out there that would be helpful to John Conyers and Bernie and, you know, anybody who's interested in single payer. Well, so, stuff like that.
You say that there's no single payer policy paper out there, which is a little staggering considering how, you know, much in vogue it is right now or how many people are talking about it. But I mean, I think like the larger issue is like, why isn't there any single payer papers out there? Like, why isn't like these, you know, we talk about think tanks a lot on the show and we sort of make fun of them. But like, there are a lot of ostensibly, I guess, left of center or liberal think tanks out there. Why aren't they doing this work? Why are you going on Patreon?
It has to do with how they're set up. So they get funding from a pretty small set of foundations that mostly have similar opinions and occasionally a rich individual here and there who's very interested in it. And those people are not, you know, they're interested in a safety net in a way, but they're not interested in transforming industry or changing the whole healthcare sector or something like that. So the funding's not there for it, and that's ultimately who pays the bills for those institutions. Beyond that, the institutions are just, they're also politically aligned with certain politicians that make it hard for them to come out for these sorts of proposals. So, you know, it's just structurally, it's, there are a lot of people in these think tanks who could produce papers like that and who are actually favorable to these policies that I know personally through back channels, but they can't do the work because there's not money for it.
The way that, I've heard think tanks described before in terms of like what they actually do is that like they, think tanks create the policy for the next administration, right? So like the Heritage or AIE spent the last 8 years of the Obama administration like crafting their messaging and like, you know, writing these papers so that like as soon as they had the chance, like it was like the template was there, they were ready to go craft the, I don't know, leech plasma out of welfare recipients act of 2017 or whatever the fuck they're working on right now that the Democrats are completely out of power. What are like the major, like, you know, sort of, I guess I'm putting this in quotation marks, left of center think tanks, like who are they and what are they doing right now? Like are the main ones sort of like Brookings and Felix mentioned Center for American Progress.
Yeah. Center for American Progress is the biggest one. I think it's annual incomes. Annual revenue is $40 to $50 million. And then you have Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which does mainly welfare policy. You have Economic Policy Institute, which is mostly labor market and is largely union funded. And then you have Roosevelt Institute and Demos, which are smaller think tanks. And I don't know, it's hard to really say where they're, what their bent is. It kind of,
don't forget the Comet Ping Pong Center for Child Welfare Research.
And then you also have CEPR, Center for Economic Policy Research, led by Dean Baker, which is the most left wing in the circle and also has the least funding. Those tend to coincide. So, you know, that's sort of the landscape. And right now what they're doing is just resistance stuff. It's just, you know, why Trump's policies are bad. Why is Trump policies are bad? That's the content that's coming out of all the think tanks at this point.
But like you described the sort of this a dynamic a little bit earlier as it pertains to, I guess, the left of center think tank world. I mean, look, the right, it's much easier for them. Like they're, all their policies and ideology is bent towards, you know, enriching oligarchs at the expense of everyone else. So they're not going to want for people to fund them or promote them. And they're not going to want for, you know, an eager crop of young sociopaths to come out of, you know, homeschool or wherever else, you know, Hillsdale University or whatever, to staff all of these. Whereas on the other side, is it like, as you alluded to, there are a lot of the people that work for them want to do this work, but their, I don't know, their aspirations or ambitions in that regard are at odds with the people who actually run them.
Right. That's exactly right. If you talk to these people, go out and have drinks with them or whatnot, a lot of them are very much on board. I mean, you think about the kind of person who wants to go into, I want to be a think tanker. They usually have some kind of, I don't know, ideology or pure policy vision that motivates them into that spot, or at least a lot of them do. But then they get into it and the political realities are such that they're just tweaking little, you know, phase-in rates here and there. There's no money for that. And they're also not allowed to separately, as individuals, you know, push their own stuff because they're supposed to be representing their policy outfit at all times. So the money just isn't there. the left, you know, left vision isn't aligned with money in general. So at best, you can have these sort of mild center left policies that are coming from foundations and some sympathetic financiers who, you know, think of themselves as really progressive, but are not really that progressive.
What Matt said about people who always wanted to be in think tanks, it made me think of the beginning of Goodfellas. Henry Hill. As long as I can remember, I always wanted to be intimidated by children. He's walking home, and he comes to his mom's house wearing a lanyard.
He's like, Henry, get inside. You look like a douchebag. Yeah.
You know, the neighborhood kids, they threw eggs at our car. You know why? Because they didn't respect me.
So, like, again, back to the idea of, like, single payer, right? Like, if you see these footage from town halls that are going on just last week, you have constituents like the guy in New Jersey, the MacArthur Amendment guy, literally has constituents yelling at him, like, why can't we have single payer? Why do they even have to be markets for healthcare in the first place? But there's this complete, you know, gap between that and, like, you're going on Patreon to get this shit started so that you can write these policy papers, whereas, you know, it's... everyone else is fucking out to lunch. So I want to ask you, like, you mentioned single payer, but, like, what are some other things that are, like, at the top of your mind? Like, if you had Entitlement Nation, the Maddie B. Stats project becomes, like, the Heritage Foundation of a resurgent left in this country, like, where would the main thrust of your energies or policies that you have in mind, like, where do you think they would be best served if you had, like, a staff of, like, really smart, bright people who wanted to make a difference? Where would their energy go?
Yeah, so for me, just based on the stuff that I'm personally familiar with, you know, on the domestic policy, the first thing you want to do is blow out a really big universal social democratic welfare state. That is, in theory, something that, you know, socialists and liberals can agree on. It's when you're pushing beyond that where there's supposed to be tensions, but weirdly in our system, liberals are not too keen on big welfare states. But so, you know, free universal health care, free child care, a year of paid parental leave, free college, better disability benefits, better elderly benefits, better unemployment benefits, just really creating a solid lock on material well-being through the welfare state is an easy step one. Beyond that,
you say step one, but all I'm seeing is just a big hand reaching into my pocket. So I'm going to ask you the question that always gets asked: who's going to pay for it?
You raise taxes. I mean, the thing about the universal welfare state is everyone benefits. So on net, what happens is it's a large redistribution relative to market outcomes from the rich to the poor and the middle class. That's the net impact of it. But overall, yeah, would be a lot higher taxes. There's some trimming you can do as well. The military budget is quite large, spend quite a bit on police and that kind of thing. But raising the tax level in order to smooth out the distribution through a big...
I'm going to have to slow you down here, Matty B. You're using a lot of big words like net and tax, and, you know, I feel like we could be throwing off some listeners here, but what if, like, expanding the aperture outside of a very strong universal welfare state, like, what would be, like, the next layer in this agenda?
So you have the welfare state, and then you have the labor market is usually piece two of a progressive economic agenda. So you have much higher taxes on the rich in order to reduce compensation to the rich. So that's an interesting burgeoning area of research that basically says that when you don't tax the rich, companies just spend a lot of money dumping money out to rich people. Whereas if you increase the taxes on them, they'll hold that money in and pay it to lower level workers. Higher minimum wage, revamp of the labor law institutions to create, you know, really strong, dense labor unions, so that you can squeeze the differential in pay between lower paid workers and higher paid workers. So in general, creating a robust, organized labor market that allows for wage coordination so that you really squeeze down inequality in pay between lower level workers and higher level workers would be step two.
Will there be a wing or department of the think tank that's just dedicated to memes and owning libs online?
Matt, you know, as a good social media strategy, Denny's, have you seen this? They'll say things like, you know, the pancakes are on fleek. It's just a lot of fun.
That's a good idea, right? The Wendy's Nuggets thing.
Yeah, be like, if this gets 17 million retweets, we'll have redistributive economics.
Gorilla, hey, guys, strategy.
You guys are chuckling, but one of the critiques that I actually saw of the Nugget asshole who got Nuggets for a year by getting over 3.8 million retweets was someone said, wow, you ask for Nuggets, but you don't ask to end racism?
That's not even the best part. That's not even the best part. People found the guy who said that. Shout out to Goolop on Twitter, one of the funniest accounts. He just searched that guy's at for black, and, ooh, boy, someone had a pre-woke period. Follow Goolop, everyone.
G-U-W-O-P.
Okay, I only had one cup of coffee today.
Stutter fuck.
Whole family is rats. Matt, I got an idea for you. So as you know, I've been making resistance t-shirts. Been doing very well with them. So, you know, you've seen my other t-shirts, like fake news is an alternative fact. Pre-existing conditions are not an alternative fact. And also, fake news is a pre-existing condition. Those are the three I made.
That's a good idea. A merch store would go well. I know there's a lot the people in my neighborhood, there are signs that say things like science matters and
whoa,
refugees welcome here, and like the homes by my house, although I live in an apartment, are like sell for $1 million or whatever, and I don't know, I find it a little unlikely that refugees are welcome in that.
But I mean, like, getting back to like this broader vision of why these things, like, even though, like, you know, even just the word think tank is almost contemptible because of its associations with basically, you know, Moloch, Asmodeus, and various other lesser and minor demons, they are. It is important because, there needs to be some kind of like infrastructure for leadership and the actual bills that become laws from a left perspective. And this is the good work that can be done. It doesn't necessarily have to be evil. There can be good produced by this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reality is that Congress is not funded well enough to produce its own policy, which is, if you read Matt Stoller's work on this, apparently a recent phenomenon, maybe starting with Reagan. They really just defunded the hell out of Congress. So at this point, Congress has almost no policymaking ability. Their staffs are full of comms people who are paid like $40 a year. And like, there's just really not a lot that can be done there. So if something's going to happen, it has to come external so that they can just kind of pick it up and pass it. And that, of course, opens up a lot of space for lobbyists to write bills, for Heritage to decide what the healthcare system looks like. Like, it's a terrible system, but to the extent that it is what it is, you want to have some platform that can actually put out policies that they can adopt and do good things with.
Absolutely. So. And if the left is going to build alternative institutions from scratch, think tank is going to have to be one of them.
Yeah, we have to have at least some credible, here's something we can do. It's scored. It's doable to at least get past, you know, the Ezra Kleins and the Paul Krugmans of the world who just want to take kind of half-baked policy efforts and slam them and say the left is goofy and ridiculous and universal health care could never work, or, you know, sort of ridiculous things like that.
Before we let you go, Matty B., we do want to just ask you about one figure who I'm sure will not take kindly to this mission or any of the policies that come out of the good work that you plan on doing. In the second half of the show, we are going to be talking about a little guy, friend of the show, Kevin D. Williamson.
Brendan, can you please insert Dracula music right there?
Organ. Drop that organ right now. And I just wanted to ask you about him because I know you've crossed swords with him before on the debate pitch.
Wait, yeah, you guys were gay?
This was before, this was when I was still in my peak harassing days, I guess. yeah, I really upset him. I mean, I had so many things. So one thing that really got him upset was, you know, when the Clippers owner said some racist things, I guess, about Magic Johnson. I don't even remember the specifics of that anymore. Donald Sterling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then they like run him out. I wrote a take on Twitter attributing it to him, saying, you know, tolerance Nazis are jackbooting Donald Sterling or something, because at the time Kevin Williamson was writing all this stuff about, you know, how pro trans people were basically like Gestapo Nazis, and people thought it was real, which I thought it was like so over the top that everyone would realize it was satire. And but people retweeted it like, oh yeah, yeah, oh my god, I can't believe Kevin Williamson is at it again, back on this bullshit, as they say. And he got pissed and has been complaining about it for years and years. He goes on speeches. He does speeches at universities and complains about me by name in front of people who have no idea who I am.
There's so many awful, monstrous things that he's actually said that it's just not fair to make things up.
Sir, right. I actually wrote the column, Planned Parenthood should have a trap door in it, as a joke. I did not say that I want to go doo-doo on a bed, okay? You were smearing me.
Well, it's impossible to satirize him as the basic problem that I've run into. Like, he is – it's – that loophole out of libel law, he's successfully destroyed it with respect to him, because no one disbelieves anything you attribute to him, no matter how ridiculous it is. Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, his we're going to be talking about his most recent one later in the show, but boy, is he a fucking monster. And not in the sense that he just looks like a corpulent Dracula type creature. Actual awful person. Real piece of shit.
Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah. Are you talking about his eviction piece?
Yeah, the eviction story. Yeah.
Yeah. That one was great. I love the notion of these people. They act like there's outside forces destroying their lives. They don't ever look at me while he's sitting in court, being an outside force destroying his life. It's the most weird.
Well, it's kind of Kevin's fault, because he's actually not able to enter their house unless they invite him in.
That's why he's in eviction court. Matty B. Stats, I want to just commend you on all the fine work you do, and plug the Patreon. We will link to it in the show's description. I am a supporter myself.
Me too.
Yeah. I'm putting my money where my mouth is. And I want in return, like I said, just some sort of honorary chair, visiting scholarship, fellow, whatever. I just, you know, gimme. I want money for nothing. Matt Brunig, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right, we are back. And to round out today's show, I think we're going to, as I previously mentioned, visit an old friend. Longtime fans of the show will remember our very second episode was entitled, We Need to Talk About Kevin.
The first Duck Hunt.
Yep.
Yeah. And Kevin kind of made us.
That was our first like successful episode, when we talked about Kevin Dracula Williamson. And I think we're going to do it again now. We still need to talk about Kevin, because he's still at it.
But to put it gently, his views are not mine. But I hope we don't get too naughty.
Lord forgive him, because Kevin's back on his shit.
Yeah. And the reason we're bringing it up is that he's had a banner week, or a banner couple of weeks, just firing out missives at the National Review. The first of which is the one that I think got the most burn, and that was an article entitled "I Am Cancer," which I gotta say is that's truth in advertising.
He's been listening to us,
yeah. I've been saying he's a tumor for a long time now.
This is a both sides thing. I agree with that,
and he is growing.
That is true. Yeah, like a tumor.
That dude is getting. He's getting swole, man. Jesus.
We were arguing before the show. Someone said that it looks like he has opiate bloat, whereas I maintain that he just has an addiction to fudge. He goes to that mall fudge shop where they have to sing to you, because he likes servitude, and that chocolatey treat. Looks to humiliate teenagers.
He's like a comic book villain where human misery makes him grow larger. Yeah. He will eventually consume the entire planet.
Now, we're referring to the fact that if you do a Google image search for Kevin D. Williamson, or just even look at his author page in the National Review and like look at his little author photo, you will see like a gaunt, almost Skeletor-like visage. But then if you look at any of his latest TV appearances, he looks like Steven Seagal, basically. He looks like if Steven Seagal just bicked his entire head and kept the Entenmann's donut goatee, it would look like Kevin D. Williamson does now. So there's something going on there. Kevin is constantly listed in the National Review as their roving correspondent. And,
roving correspondent just means a correspondent who happens to be a peeping Tom.
Well, as you said, I think he's been roving into Candyland, basically.
Yep, yeah. He's got lost somewhere around the Hershey Highway.
In the Willy Wonka factory. He's been underneath that chocolate waterfall for the last month or so.
He went into the waterfall like Augustus Gloop, but instead of being sucked up and dying, he just drank it dry and was like, pathetic.
When Kevin finally dies from all the fudge, that's actually the first scene of Seven when Brad Pitt goes to the house and sees the gluttony victim.
Well, I mean, it's fitting because he's a guy that basically blames basically any bad thing that happens to any individual as being 100% entirely their fault. So, you know, when he loses a foot, we'll know what to think. So the I Am Cancer piece is the one that everyone shared the most. And the subhead is The View from Eviction Court. And this is, yeah, he's roving again. And he's writing these sort of literary-like dispatches from his own life.
What do you mean roving? That's just some shit he had to do.
The rascal scootering correspondent.
So I'm going to just read here now from the first piece. The View from Eviction Court. My check didn't come. Eviction court is not the saddest place in the world, but if you were taking a Dantean descent through the underworld of underclass despair and dysfunction, it would be somewhere around the fourth or fifth circle, because my Virgil on this journey is an actual attorney, with a suit and tie and everything. So that's his opening paragraph, already adhering to the conservative house style of name-checking either a classic writer of the Renaissance, antiquity, or George Orwell, and then having like a cutesy little thing, a lawyer with a suit and tie and everything. That's, you know, a little limp stab at humor. So he says, the judge has moved us to the end of the docket on the theory that there might be arguments in our case.
And the fear that I would tip the docket over if I stayed on that side.
That this litigation might turn into something resembling litigation. There are not going to be any arguments, but we get to sit through a few hours worth of very sad stories. I think the lawyer enjoys these even less than I do, even though he gets paid by the hour. So he's already doing the facts don't care about your sad stories. There won't be any arguments, only argument from anecdote, which, as we know, is not an argument. He goes on to describe some of the unfortunates that he's going to heap contempt on later. She talks about blah, 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 but whatever her disability is, it does not appear to be the worst of her problems. She has a daughter and a man in her life. It is not clear whether he is her husband or the girl's father or both or neither. And they are obligated to maintain two separate households because of, quote, the domestic event that happened. The teacher in me cannot help but notice when it comes time to explain the facts of the case. The people in this courtroom rarely appear as the subjects in their own sentences. A domestic event just happened.
The teacher in Kevin is Dr. Pepper. That's what's rolling around inside him.
So he goes on, domestic events happen. Checks don't come. Checks come or they don't. Mostly they don't. Husbands are sent to jail. Children are taken away by clipboard-toting minions of authority. Disease descends. The money isn't there. And in the end, they're evicted. Bad things just happen. And today, I am the bad thing that is just happening to one of those luckless and unhappy children of God. I am eviction. I am CPS. I am the check that didn't come. I am diabetic amputation. I am cancer.
So these people are just there. This is, you know, maybe one of the lowest moments of their lives, and they're describing things like diabetic amputations and having cancer. And he's there like, poor choices, I see.
Well, this is like that little flourish there, the I am cancer line, is the thing that sort of as we alluded to earlier, would inspire someone like Chris Hayes to say, you know, Kevin's views may not be my own, but, you know, man, he can write. And I suppose he can write if you're, you know, stable that you're standing next to includes Jonah Goldberg, David French, and, you know, Jim Garrity and the baseball crank, who are, you know, among the worst prose stylists alive. The fact that he can inject a little bit of flair into his otherwise completely conventional cruelty and banality is, in fact, not that impressive. At least,
yeah. Congratulations, you write better than David fucking French. Wow, none of them.
Because they all suck. Yeah. That's the
they
thing.
All suck.
And like, well, this is another object lesson. Stop trying to fucking pick the corn kernels out of the pile of shit. It's all a pile of shit.
Oh, I do like the George Will articles that are 75% just Spurgy baseball stats that he thinks are profound or interesting.
The next George Will is going to come from like Internet Pepe guys. He's going to do the same thing, but with esports. Yeah, just long analogies about it.
Not if I don't do it first.
about how Overwatch is the beautiful game.
Dota 2, the gentleman's
name. I got a new project.
So Kevin continues here. I am, as it happens, evicting my mother's fourth husband's fifth wife from a modest house, much more modest than the condition I left it in, which is, you know, like chocolate handprints on the wall, piles of small children's shoes. I inherited the house from my mother when she died, and her husband inherited a life estate in it, meaning a legal right to reside there so long as he kept current on the taxes and such. He remarried, and then in parentheses, these are remarrying people. Like, again, what the fuck does that aside mean?
What does that mean?
Who aren't remarrying people? Oh, they got a second husband? Like, who the fuck are you comparing them to here? You, who's apparently never had a relationship or been married?
So Kevin's never been married, is what you're saying?
I don't think so. Who cares? He has three wives that sleep in coffins in his fucking basement and come out at night.
I'm thinking of a Night on Bald Mountain joke, but it's probably not going to land because it's too cultured. So I'm just going to leave it.
I would have gotten it.
I was mad that I spent that great Stone Cold Steve Austin joke on the
best joke in the history of the show is Felix in episode 2 calling Kevin Williamson Cold Stone Steve Austin.
That one too early.
Yeah, you idiot.
I know. We have way more listeners now and my genius would be appreciated, but whatever.
So continuing on here. Why are you doing this to us? The woman's daughter demanded. And then I want to just mention here that the rest of this graph, he puts all in italics because he's a good writer. This is, you know, what good prose stylists do. Why are you doing this to us? Because I am the bad thing that is just happening to you today. The unforeseeable event that has been hanging over you by a single hair of a horse's tail for a decade. The inevitable end of a terrible lamentation. He's like fucking Ned Beatty in Network right now. He's just ripping off movies at this point.
Foolish mortals, I am the bad thing.
He's the Colonel Sanders guy from The Matrix.
The guy in the architect.
The architect.
Yeah.
Except he actually is eating KFC. well, Mr. Anderson,
ergo proctor.
Stop eating Double Downs. Where's Trinity?
Yeah, no, what he says here is, but people love their sad stories. They feel compelled to tell them. And like, again, this is another tick that you see in the National Review and other sort of highbrow conservative outlets is that they always think that, like, for instance, about the latest healthcare debacle, that, you know, the people's sort of instinctual moral revulsion at like the suffering that's going to be caused by it in their fellow human beings. If politicians bring that up or evoke that in any way, they always think that that's like some kind of cheat code, that it's not fair or something like that, that they're getting away with something by acknowledging the terrible human toll of their policies, or just talking about anything in a way that doesn't make you seem like some sort of ghoul or undead.
It's the impulse from fifth grade where you want to be the future supervillain of the class.
Well, I think it's more than that. I think for guys like Kevin, they like capitalism not for the reasons that people lie to credulous audiences and say they like capitalism, because it creates wealth and it promotes freedom. They like it because they see the market as something that punishes the weak and the undeserving. Yeah. And they are deeply invested in that punishment being meted out. And government intervention is something that prevents people who need to be punished from getting their rightful punishment.
that's the Calvinist side of conservatism, but it's particularly interesting going back a little bit how these people always go, well, people love their sad stories and their emotional appeals, but if you read any of these writers, you know, just put a blindfold on and click on any author page and anything they've written in their entire catalog at National Review, 70% of it are grievances. 70% of it are like David French when he got fooled by a child in an office basketball
Nerdlinger, because he's nervous around the Black History Museum.
Yeah. It's just all times that they went somewhere and they weren't feared and respected, which is their entire lives, because any normal person that sees them goes, what's this fucking sentient thumb that's ambling around me talking about thug culture? But, you know, those are legitimate grievances because they reflect some sort of decline of the culture. But people's actual physical pain and endangerment and death and despair doesn't count.
Well, they have it coming because they should have made better decisions in their lives.
And this is
of course, the thing that always ignores is that everybody fucks up and makes bad decisions. I mean, look at literally any garment of clothing that Kevin Williamson has ever worn in his life. But those bad decisions have manifestly worse impact on people who aren't protected by a nice fat layer of social hierarchy and money.
Also, a nice fat layer of fat.
They want the market to be this avenging angel, but it only avenges on the people who've had the misfortune to be born wrong, basically. And they just at a certain point have to have metabolized an idea whereby, yeah, the Calvinist notion of, well, you know, yes, they are suffering mostly not because of their choices, because plenty of rich people make worse choices and never suffer the consequences of them. They're primarily suffering because they don't have money to compensate for the bad choices they make. And at a certain level, you just have to have in your bones the belief that, well, they shouldn't have been born that way. Like that there was some sort of cosmic justice in them being born into a subordinate position, and that therefore those choices they make have to have as negative consequences as possible, so that the only people who are rewarded are the people who are born poorly but then show their worth. And guys like Kevin especially think of themselves as that. Like those guys are the guys who weren't born into money and then make some sort of success in life, like this guy, like J.D. Vance, are the worst, because they think that by virtue of having gotten out of those conditions intact, that shows them to be worthy. And people who have demonstrated their value, and that allows them to look down on everyone else. It makes them have to look down on everyone else and condemn them, because that's the only way that they can exalt themselves.
Well, Matt, what he does in the rest of the article is that he sort of sets up a contrast between, you know, his usual beat, which is kind of sneering at the poor crackers that he was able to escape, who are, you know, begging him to let them stay rent free in this house they've lived in, or on disability, or not working, or are, you know, as he said, the remarrying type, with his lawyer and immigrant gas station attendants, who he credits as having a better work ethic than these sort of the country types that he despises so much. I'm reading here now. He talks about his lawyer. He says, I'll give you a break on my rate, says my lawyer, looking at his watch. He is the son of Mexican-American farm laborers who learned at least one thing from his hard and poor childhood. Don't be a farm laborer. Law looked like a pretty good alternative, and it seemed to be working out pretty well for him. The idiomatic English would be, he became a lawyer. The better English would be, he made himself a lawyer.
Why would that be the better?
Another fucking terrible writing lesson.
Thank you, Chris Hayes, for pointing us to this brilliant writer.
Yeah. Hope this goes on the syllabus.
Yeah. How did that happen? It must have begun with decisions he made as a child or as a very young man. A leads to B, B leads to C, C leads to a good income and a nice house and a bass boat.
Are the alphabet, those letters leading to each other, is that the progression of Kevin's diabetes?
And then he goes on for some more hardscrabble bootstrapping that is, you know, again, you've read this article a zillion times before, but I guess he punches it up with a little bit of his sort of glee and contempt. But and then he closes out by saying, And while I'm not much of a hard ass on these kinds of questions, we have a positive moral obligation to help the poor, and not just deserving poor.
Does not mean that for a second.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. Lie. Yeah. I cannot help but think of those hustling immigrants when I encounter the native-born sons and daughters of this sweet land of liberty who, if it were raining jobs and opportunity, would find a way to walk between the raindrops. My check didn't come. Did you pay rent in January? The factory closed down. The textile jobs moved to Thailand and Vietnam. Hey. My little town is dying. My check didn't come. Did you pay any rent in February and March? My check didn't come. Your check didn't come. It's never coming.
I'm being
now what?
Crushed, destroyed by massive material influences that are beyond my control.
Mr. Williamson, the doctor says I have to eat these vitamin gummies. Please stop eating the entire bottle.
Well, as Matt Brunig alluded to, like, the whole point of this article is that, like, he's, you know, basically, like, you know, sneering and mocking these people for complaining about, like, these forces outside of their life that are, you know, crushing them and grinding them down, like, you know, their inability to pay rent, their fact that they're disabled, probably drug addiction, break family, whatever. And, like, he is taking joy in those italicized points about being that outside force. And what's also funny is that he is scolding again these poor crackers and these white trash people who he really hates for not being more, you know, active like his Mexican American lawyer or Indian gas station attendants or something. But he's doing all this while taking place in a legal proceeding so that he can continue to collect rent from a property he inherited. So yeah, that's how I got to be the new Criterion's theater critic.
He actually, there was a challenge. They said, Kevin, if you can sleep in this haunted house overnight, it's yours.
And he never left.
Yeah.
And just that's Kevin D. Williamson. But just as a slight bonus, I want to turn to his colleague Jonah Goldberg, who was, and this is an example.
Another hard scrabble son of toil who brought himself up purely by his own talent.
I can't believe we've actually never done. I don't think we've ever done Jonah.
No, we haven't.
No, we have not. Astoundingly.
We roasted him a little bit on the Bill Corbett episode because he showed up in Dinesh D'Souza's movie about Hillary.
So you guys remember Jonah from the Bible? He got swallowed by a whale. This is kind of the exact opposite.
It's amazing because Jonah is, like, I think the greatest right-wing fail son.
Yeah.
The greatest right-wing fail son. Is, unlike Kevin, has all of the same beliefs, is exactly as sort of, like, you know, callous and incurious, but has none of even the slightest bit of flair and is just, like, writes every word just landing, like, just a little fart in his hands. So Jonah Goldberg is, of course, reacting to the sort of the clip of Jimmy Kimmel, you know, talking about his newborn son's health problems and connecting it to this awful AHCA that went viral and became a huge sort of moment in the last weeks. And basically, again, people are feeling an innate sense of revulsion and anger over the cruelties inherent in the AHCA. Jonah Goldberg's job is to find something wrong with that and promote rotten right-wing healthcare policy. So he's going to find a weird way to do it. And he does it in the title, The Dangers of Empathy. It can distract us from rational thought and meaningful compassion. Jonah is going to open up by talking about his own sad story. He says, just over 14 years ago, my daughter almost died minutes before entering the world. My wife had to have an emergency C-section. The whole thing was harrowing. Someday I'll tell the whole story.
His wife had an emergency cesarean and he had an emergency Caesar salad.
He says, someday I'll tell the whole story, not now because I'm not a good enough writer. Because of that experience, and simply because I am a father, I could empathize with late-night host Jimmy Kimmel's story about his son's birth.
That's dangerous.
He's already flirting with disaster here.
I don't like this story.
Yeah, he's walking on thin ice, or really, that's any ice that Jonah walks on. This is the most fat jokes I've ever done in an episode.
And he goes, empathy is different than sympathy or compassion. Sympathy is when you feel sorry for someone. Compassion is when you do something about it. Again,
that's not the English language.
We're going back to the same house style of the National Review. Define words if you ever need to pad out column space. And the move he does here is that he finds the work of some as he describes him, a liberal sociologist or researcher, someone who researches the brain. And this is another like little thing. He references the fact that, did you know that you can see parts of the brain light up when people experience empathy?
I, too, am a student of the brain and psychology and success.
Yeah, according to psychology, damn, it's true facts. People with empathy are less likely to be honest, procrastinate, stay up late, swear, and are always fake and love drama.
Did you know that when you think about someone you love, they're 100% chance that you're thinking about you too?
Yeah. So he references some, for at least for the sake of argument, I'll pretend not spurious social science, or at least grant him that he's interpreting the work of this guy correctly and hasn't just sort of like tossed off something very, you know, that he read and half remembered.
Doubtful.
But this is where he gets on. He says, many people, when some people think about empathy, they think about kindness. I think about war, Bloom writes. He's got a point. Look at the Middle East today. Sunni nations empathize with the plight of suffering Sunnis, and that empathy causes them to further hate and demonize the Shiites. It also causes you to do the same, Jonah. Many people around the world empathize with the Palestinians. Again, there's another big problem for Jonah.
Hate that.
But he says, blinding them to the legitimate concerns of the Israelis. And vice versa, he adds,
legitimate
quite charitably.
Concerns about Israelis. Like, where are we going to throw these white phosphorus grenades if we don't throw them here?
Here's where it gets really good. Adolf Hitler was a master of empathy.
Uncontroversial.
Okay.
Okay.
A master of empathy for ethnic Germans in the Sudetenland, Austria. The cause of nationalist empathy for the German tribe triggered profound moral blindness for the plight and even humanity of Jews, Gypsies, and Slavs.
I just want to. All right. So I'm assuming, since this is about healthcare, that the Jews in this are health insurance executives?
Exactly what I've been saying.
Matt, I don't even think it's that connected at all.
He doesn't tie it back to
he doesn't. I don't think he does. I think he's just talking about the dangers of empathy, which in his case means the empathy for one racial group and the hatred of all others.
That's the way we all understand empathy to mean. Very selective empathy for a racial cadre. And that's the way we all think of it. At least that's the way he thinks of it. Well, this just shows, like, when you get to something like healthcare and you see just how savage and idiotic it is. I mean, it not only does it leave people out in the lurch and dying of untreated illnesses, it costs more than it does anywhere else. It doesn't even make rational sense. Like, you can't even make the rational case for it. So these guys, when they're pressed on it, they just panic and like shoot a bunch of squid ink and then just like hope that you get lost in the fog of it. So you're like, you know what? I thought that single payer was sort of a moral and frankly, fiduciary duty, but now I'm worried that it'll make me Hitler, I guess. I don't know. Where am I? I smell toast.
Yeah. The squid ink in this piece is defining words, giving like a fifth grade level introduction to Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust. And, you know, with a patina of sort of research done by a real scientist. So here he goes. Jonah continues here. Human beings are naturally inclined to sympathize and empathize with people like them. There has never been a society where people didn't give priority to helping family and friends over strangers. Just stating just the most banal observations
imaginable. That's true according to brain psychology.
Yeah, he's reading like, yeah, Google psychology facts.
This tends to blind us to the suffering of those we do not or cannot empathize with. Empathy is biased, pushing us to the direction of parochialism and racism. Again, this is hilarious coming in the pages of the National Review.
And it's about healthcare, which is about people you don't know writ large.
Yeah.
So what? I don't even know where he is now. With this.
So there'd be like an Adolf Hitler, but he's Hitler for people with cancer.
Wait, guys, bear with me here. Bear with me here.
You're right. I'm sure it's going to come together.
Look at the intractable debate over the phrase Black Lives Matter. The slogan itself is kind of a spotlight, argue supporters, highlighting the legitimate complaints of African Americans. But it also blinds them to why others respond to the term by saying all lives matter. I don't go as far as Bloom. That's the researcher or scientist whose work is, I'm sure, he's bastardizing here, in detesting empathy.
After all, it's done great things like look at Hitler in the Sudetenland.
He said, I don't go as far as Bloom in detesting empathy. Again, I don't think Bloom really detests
this
empathy
Alan
here.
Bloom,
yeah, Alan Bloom, yeah. It's Leopold Bloom, actually.
Oh, yeah. Oh, shit.
Another person Hitler didn't have empathy for. It seems to me not only natural, but also defensible to give priority to figuratively kindred people. England is a lot like more like America than, say, Singapore. That's similar.
So, wait a minute. So, I mean, he can't be speaking about anything other than racial solidarity, right?
I think that's basically what he's getting to. He's, similarity has forged a long and important bond, both formally, e.g. treaties, shared institutions, and informally, in terms of emotional and cultural bond. If England were attacked, our empathy for its plight would inform our response in ways that I think are important and useful. It would
and
also
racially motivated.
Yeah, I thought that was bad.
Yeah, yeah.
If I thought having empathy with other people to go to war on their behalf was bad. Yeah. And Hitler-like.
Again, the goal here is to get people to be like, Jimmy Kimmel's story about his infant son is bad. You shouldn't feel sympathy for him or other people like it. I'll tell you why. But what he does is just do this two-step back and forth where he doesn't say anything. Empathy. Is it good? Is it bad? A feeling of many contrasts. And but then doesn't say anything.
Jonah would do the maze on the back of like a fucking children's placemat at a restaurant and like get scared midway through that he's all actually lost in it.
Now we get to the money graph here. But where I agree with Bloom is that empathy alone is dangerous and can distract us from rational thought. Which brings me back to Jimmy Kimmel. His story about his son aroused a riot of empathy across the nation. A riot of empathy.
You know, all those broken windows from empathy and motorists pulled from their cars and stomped from empathy.
A crystal knocked of empathy.
Paul Ryan and the authors of the AHCA are like the Reginald Denny of this outbreak of empathy in America. So Kimmel used that response to make an argument about healthcare policy that was largely devoid of any consideration of the facts, trade-offs, or costs of what is the best way to deal with people.
It's cheaper, you cock-fucking motherfucker!
I thought Jimmy Kimmel was talking about the trade-offs, like, are we going to like have people with pre-existing conditions to be fucking have health care? He was largely wrong on the facts. Babies with dire medical conditions are covered by their parents' insurance. What if they don't have insurance?
All parents have insurance.
Oh, wait a second.
You didn't know that?
And when their parents are uninsured, doctors don't just let the baby die on the table. Huh. Oh, phew. Oh, that is God. A load off. Ooh.
They let them go home, and then they let them die at home.
Yeah, by the way.
And that's literally true. Lots of the parts of this country have fucking third world level child mortality rates because all of this vaunted free healthcare that people keep talking about, it means you got to revive someone if they're dying in front of you. But then you send them home. If they die at home, they're not your problem anymore.
I love that Jonah took the time to reassure his readers that doctors don't just let babies die on the table.
Yeah, are all his readers like 9 years old?
Yeah, this is incredible. He's just telling, like, he's
doctor is a special type of, it's above a nurse, first of all. And
can I also just say, I guarantee somewhere in the pages of the National Review is an editorial calling for repeal of the bill that requires doctors to treat the elderly.
Almost certainly.
Yeah. Guaranteed.
Almost certainly. He goes, and then he goes back again. He does another shuffle here. That doesn't mean there aren't inequities in the system or that the current healthcare regime is anywhere close to perfect. But it is very difficult to have a rational discussion about the trade-offs inherent in any healthcare system, including socialized medicine, where all anyone can think about is the ordeal of a newborn baby and his loving parents.
It's literally
should be people be thinking about other than like actual human suffering and life and death? What should they be thinking about?
I don't know.
Bottom line, you fat fucking twat.
Why should we be thinking about health in a healthcare discussion?
He doesn't even mention any of the trade-offs that he's supposedly talking about here.
That's
it all ends up being, as you said, Edna's bottom line. Like, if you revealed what he wants to caution against, what he wants to caution against is reducing profits of insurance companies. And if he put it that way, everyone would say, oh, well, fuck them.
That's a lot of words just to say, don't think about the baby. Just don't think about the baby. Like, this is the best they got.
And he opened the article with, think about my baby, not Jimmy Kimmel.
Yes. One day I'll tell the story once someone actually asks to hear this one.
But, you know, we mentioned that Jonah was maybe like one of the greatest fail sons of the right. I don't know. He's in a conversation with John Podhoretz, definitely. Yeah,
yeah. I think Podhoretz is like a little bit above him because of the thing about having to be pulled away from
he
the
He is
TV.
A better writer. I mean,
yeah. He's a better tweeter, too.
Yes.
He's like
Town and Country, 2016, top tweeter.
Yeah.
But for those of you who don't know, Jonah's mom is Lucy Ann Goldberg, who is a very, very early like right-wing blogger, like early in like sort of Matt Drudge style, who just had like a news aggregator site that literally just collected links about crimes committed against white people by street thugs and gangs in the inner city. But she was also most famous for being Linda Tripp's friend and close confidant who recorded their phone conversations and encouraged Linda Tripp to tell Monica Lewinsky to save the famous blue dress. And it was like, I believe it was even in her possession at one point. And I just like to imagine that the stain on that blue dress was actually just little Jonah's saliva, just his sort of like sugar, thick, viscous, mucousy saliva drooling onto the dress. And they were like, it's come.
It's leaking down his lapel at this very moment, still to this day.
Even now, Jonah, at like 50-something years old, his hands are always sticky. He's always got like honey buns stuck on his cheek. He's a treat boy.
Jonah Goldberg, absolute treat boy. And his colleague, Kevin D. Williamson.
Bat boy.
That's a good one.
There we go.
Weird thing about Jonah, though. We've talked about his mom, but his dad is actually Goldberg, the WWE wrestler.
Contra Jonah, I do have empathy for all the residents of Pepperidge Farms that Kevin evicted.
Okay, always a pleasure to dip back into the pages of the National Review.
Perambulating the dingo once again.
We're on our way now, Ducky! We're on our way to next show. Till next time. Bye.
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 Fallen hero.
Wait, let me think about how I'm going to do this.
Let me retake one line. If you're waiting for me to screw up, Agent Haynes, I suggest you eat fresh, because it's not going to be... I can't see what... I suggest you eat fresh, because it's not going to be happening for a pretty gosh darn foot long time.
This is vile. This is art, you piece of shit.